You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. Then you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy, crazy.
I wanted to fame, but not the cover of Newsweek.
All right, it's official. The bumper music's all screwed up this morning. So, with that said, joining us from someplace in Virginia, Alex Hollings. Alex, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Hey, not too bad, man. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, come on. You're like a crowd pleaser, so it's easy. The we're in Virginia, are you? We're familiar with it, so make it.
I couldn't even tell you.
I
think I'm about 80 miles from Roanoke, somewhere on Route 81, but that's about as specific as I could get. I have no idea where I am.
Well, 80 miles from Roanoke, you're deep into Virginia. Yeah, you're deep in Virginia. So, anyway, for those of you who aren't familiar with Alex, Alex is a former Marine and a rider right now, a senior rider at SoftRep. Alex, tell everybody where they can find your work.
Well, you can find me, obviously, at SoftRep.com. But if you want to find my social media, you can find me on Facebook at Facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter or on Twitter at AlexHollings52.
There you have it. Covers the world. The I'm curious about the Commandant came out last week and said three-man fire teams, a squad leader, an assistant squad leader, and a tech person. Were you surprised? Three-man fire teams? That's kind of tiny. The Marine Corps has never had three-man fire teams. We've had two five-man fire teams. We've had 3 4-man fire teams. We've never had 3 3 Marine fire teams. You surprised at that?
I was, honestly. You know, I can understand the idea behind it. You know, because when you're talking about a fire team, it's not uncommon at all to have, you know, a junior lance corporal or maybe a bit of an experienced lance corporal in charge of a fire team. I can understand the idea, I suppose, of minimizing the amount of authority that that fire team leader may have, but honestly, I like the idea of a 5-man fire team more than a 3-man. I'm sure, just like all things, this is one of those things where we're going to try it, we're going to see if it works for a while. If it turns out it's not as effective, you know, I'm sure we'll end up making changes. I just hope that it's not the sort of thing where it turns out it's not as effective, and that results in losing Marines. You know?
Yeah. My youngest son was involved in the Sea Dragon 2025 stuff with 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. And they had, I want to say, 11 Marine squads. They had, I want to say, 15 Marine squads. And maybe, I don't know. So there was a number. And so I asked him, I said, well, which one, what do you think?
Yeah, what was more effective? How did it work with him? Yeah.
And he said, well, he said, probably the thing that we learned was that there was no single solution for, and this, like, I never thought my kid, well, I used to think he was smart when he was little, but then, you know, you know what I mean? When they go through their teenage years, you look and you're like, are you kidding me? Like, are you stupid? And when you say that often enough, then it, like, occurs to you, like, he's stupid. So then he says something like pretty smart, and he said, we would change our organization based on our mission. So, for instance, if speed was more important, right, then we would configure, you know, we would configure a certain way. If firepower we thought was going to be more important, we would probably have bigger teams and more centralized. And so I thought, whoa.
That's an excellent idea. I worry about training the small unit leader to be able to effectively make that determination. I guess that could be difficult, but I love the idea. You know, the same way I look at technology. You know, everything in the military is moving towards modular technology.
Right.
We want to be able to take the same basic premise and shift its function based on the purpose that we need it to fulfill right now, right? We want our battleships to be able to change weapon loadouts. We want our aircraft to be able to do the same. I think it makes sense that as we move forward, we expect our personnel to change their organizational hierarchy to suit the needs of the mission, as opposed to trying to find a way to make the mission fit into our hierarchy. I think that's brilliant. I love that.
Yeah, don't be hesitant with the word brilliant, okay? The he was headed to the range this morning, right? Weapons draw 0-300.
Oh,
I said, yo, bro, that leaves a mark, doesn't it? He's like, are you kidding me? I said,
see,
that's
tough, man, because we all had hard days in the Corps, but very few of us had a dad talking about it on the radio.
But,
you know?
Do you remember that? You hear 0-3, weapons draw. Yeah, sir, we got to make sure we got everything drawn, and then we're going to be out every formation 0-4. Got it. Well, wait a minute. What time are we shooting?
You know that's
what
the
time
classic chain. It was,
yeah, but
you know,
what time are we
said,
shooting?
You know, one guy said 0-6, so it went down the chain to 0-5-45, which went down to 0-5-30. I don't know how you managed 0-3. I remember in 29 pounds being out there for weapons draw at 0-5. And knowing full well we'd have no sunlight for 3 hours.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But I mean, that's actually what made me buy my first iPhone, was sitting out at the range having nothing to do for hours and hours. And I was like, shit, man, I'm going to buy one of those new phones that you can watch cartoons and stuff on. And I've never gone back. That was my first smartphone.
In response to, well, yeah, you can imagine. Like, so they might not only need a smartphone out there right now, but they need a battery charger, because when you get there, when you draw weapons at 0-3, your ass is going to be out there for a while.
Oh, man, they're going to do the safety brief at 0-8, because you know that the range coaches and stuff like that, they're not coming in early for your ass. They don't care about you.
Exactly. I was like, damn. So, yeah, anyway, no, but yeah, so be careful with the B word, brilliant. But, you know, I do think, and again, you know, the team leaders probably wouldn't make that call. Probably the platoon commander, in conjunction with the platoon sergeant, company commander, it'd be like, you know what, we want to be heavier here. The problem with the three-man fire team, 12-man squad, first of all, you won't deploy as full-up round at 12. You'll probably have 10.
That's true.
Right? So now right? So now you're like, all right, what do? We got the assistant squad leader. Our command cell is as big as our fire teams now. Okay, right? So, tech guy, you're going to dual hat as you're going to be the grenadier for this team, and the assistant squad leader, you're going to be with that team, and so now they're both going to be five-man teams, or we're going to get close to five, blah, blah, blah. So, that's normally how it works.
The other concern I have with that three-man fire team is like, so I'm always, you know, I plan for redundancy in everything that I do,
right?
And you have to anticipate casualties in a combat situation.
Okay.
And when you have a three-man fire team, one casualty has a much more significant effect on your combat effectiveness.
Yeah, it eliminates the whole team.
Absolutely. You know, because if you have one casualty, it's going to take the other two guys that are still in the fight to keep you safe until we can get somebody to you,
right.
You know?
Or to drag your ass someplace, the casualty collection point, right? At the squad level, you got to get them out of there, you know, and then those guys, you know, come back right away. But, yeah, you're smaller, that's an issue. So it'll be interesting to hear the analysis and the rationale and whatnot. But, yeah. No.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, I've got another question for you. This is a current event thing. I have some friends that I met, a guy named Ken Falk, retired EOD Navy guy, and his ops guy, a guy named Josh Goldberg, who was who's a civilian. They run a place called Boulder Crest Retreat. You heard of it? They do post-traumatic stress.
I haven't, no.
All right, non-medicated. And so they bring people in and say, okay, look, there's a concept out there called post-traumatic growth which was done by a researcher. I want to say his name is Tedaschke, but I know I just got it wrong. But anyway, he was doing research on the effect on having a child with terminal cancer has on parents. And what he found was quite surprising, that parents grew out of that experience. They became better parents. They became better spouses. And so they coined this term post-traumatic growth, which I know you've heard. Anyway, they've written a book called struggle well. And it has to do with the way they see the path to post-traumatic growth from trauma. And the military has not cornered the market on trauma. It applies to a lot of different applies to a lot of different people. So what they're trying to
do, and we certainly haven't cornered the market on PTSD either.
No,
you know,
absolutely,
that's a great point.
Right, and so anyway, the foreword in that book is written by a guy named Charlie Plum, retired Navy captain, prisoner for 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton, and
oh,
so
Jesus.
Yeah, so they're talking about those guys and Charlie Plum and why they wanted him to write it. And I said, wait, 4% from, and then out of this discussion comes, yeah, well, the post-traumatic stress rate out of the Hanoi Hilton is 4%. And I said, hold on a second. Something's wrong with my headphones because I just heard you say 4%. Did you mean 44?
Yeah.
Did you mean 44% or 94%? What did you mean?
Yeah, because if you told me 40%, I would still say that sounds like a low number. I know people mean stress in different ways, but that's one of the most high stress environments that you could put a human being into.
They said,
you know?
No, 4%. And so.
So now what's the variable then? What's the variable between
welcome,
the situation that they were in,
welcome,
and their recovery rate?
Welcome to my weekend. Now, there's another documentary that if you haven't watched it, I want you to watch it. Write it down right now. It's called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. It's about Marines. Bravo Company 126 at Khe Sanh and the 77 days of that siege and all the shit they went through. And then at the end of it, they talk about life after Vietnam. Talk about becoming a closet veteran. I never spoke about it. Never told people I was a veteran. People I know were shocked when I told them I was in Vietnam. And they talked about, you know, self-medicating with alcohol. They talked about relationship problems. And so what it got me to thinking was exactly what you already arrived at. Footnote, how you get to 4%. Because I see these guys. And I can understand why they're at 30%, which is the average for Vietnam. And so, anyway, any thoughts on
so
that?
So I suppose one question I have about that 4% figure is it's obviously self-reporting, you know? And I have to wonder about the generational gap in the way that you self-report. Because, I mean, the things that you're saying there rings very true to my father's experience as a Vietnam veteran. You know, in our home, he was always very proud of his service and very proud of being a Vietnam vet. He wasn't particularly proud of the U.S. government, necessarily. He wasn't always a big government supporter. But, there's a big reason why I chose to serve when I grew up, you know. I mean, I grew up in a house that respected service. But my dad wasn't the type of guy that you would know that he was a Vietnam veteran or a veteran at all or that he had been a soldier. You know, at first glance, or even you could know my dad for years, maybe, and not necessarily know. It wasn't something he advertised. Another thing he didn't advertise were his emotional struggles. You know, my father was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in his late 60s, and it certainly didn't develop in his late 60s, you know. And I have to wonder if there's a difference in the way that we are willing to self-report and identify these problems when it comes to doing these clinical studies or seeking help, that maybe the previous generations were kind of more keen to just drape away their problems, and the younger generation, you know, the guys that are more my age and younger, maybe they're more willing, maybe the culture has become more accepting of looking for help, and maybe that's why we see a higher statistical ratio. I'm just spitballing on that, but it seems crazy to me that the rate would be so low.
Doesn't it? So I was one of the things that I was, Almer and Rader was helping out with was, the documentary Bravo is on Amazon. So if you have Amazon Prime, you can check it out.
Oh, you got it. I'll watch it when I get home then. That sounds great.
It's intense. I'm telling you, it is, if you want to talk, I think it's such a great mental health, documentary because, Ken Rogers was a Lance Corporal there. He's not a filmmaker. He had gone to reunions. His wife, Betty, says to him, you know, we should really record some of this stuff. And him being an infantry lance corporal says, huh? And then she slapped him a few times. And so they, you know, they send out a letter to everybody. Hey, if you would like to participate, you know, we're gonna record this stuff and try to make a documentary out of it. So it's awesome. It's the best documentary I've ever seen about combat. And
I love that because it's made by the people who were involved, as opposed to a filmmaker getting an idea and pursuing a story or a narrative.
Right.
Real life rarely happens with a beginning, middle, and end, and like a neat narrative that you can throw together. But that's how we like stories to be. So I feel like when filmmakers try to make documentaries through no fault of their own, but when they try to make documentaries about things that they don't have firsthand experience with, a lot of times they try to create this narrative that makes sense. You know, it's something that you can follow easily and is logical, because that's the way we'd like things to be. But when people make documentaries based on their own personal experiences, it doesn't have to fall into perfect logical place. It just needs to be a recounting of your experiences, you know? And that's much more true to life. You know, in real life, doesn't always work with like there isn't a cause and effect. You know, a Chekhov's gun is something they teach you in screenwriting, where if the gun appears in the first act, it's got to be fired in the third act. You know, that's how storytelling in Western civilization tends to travel. You introduce things in the first act, the second act creates a conflict that creates a change and forces you to use some of those things introduced in the first act, and then in the third act you get a culmination. Documentaries shouldn't always have that, in my opinion, because real life doesn't have that, you know? And so when it's guys that were really there making it, if it's got that means it was there. If it doesn't have it, it means that it wasn't there. You know, I love that idea of the story being told by the people that lived it, as opposed to kind of shoehorning in people's stories into a narrative a filmmaker envisions, you know?
Well, you know, and that's exactly what he did was, and I think one of the mental health lessons is you see these guys talking about it, you know, you'll know that they look, as they're telling the story, they're living it. It's so, and this is 47 years after the event, I think, when they did it. And you're just sitting there thinking, wow, it's as vivid to them. And there's one guy in there, and I want to have you back on after you see it, but there's one guy named Frank McCauley in there. He's in the trench that he's talking about. He's raising his fingers and shooting people, and he reminds me of George Costanza because right. I mean, he's talking about this attack they do, and I'll just the first part of the movie is they just talk about Quezon, what it was like to live there, to be there. Then when the attack started in the ammo dump, they were right next to the ammo dump. If you can imagine this shit show, the ammo dump gets hit by one of the first round. The CS in the ammo dump is cooking off. And where does CS go? Low ground. Where are they? In trenches.
Yep.
Where are their gas masks? Nobody really knows, right? And so if this,
absolutely.
Right, if this thing can't get worse, they're getting annihilated by indirect fire. They're getting hammered by indirect fire. And now we're going to do CS gas. Like, what in the hell? But anyway, they go through that. Then they send out a patrol they call the Ghost Patrol. And of the approximately 60 guys went out, approximately 30 are killed. And, right, their intel wasn't good about who was around them. They evidently get hit, a reinforced platoon gets hit by what they thought was, they walked in between two battalions, and they just get annihilated. And so, and they can't go get the bodies, so the bodies stay out there. And, exactly, and then you know how that is as Marines. So about a month later, they go back for what they call.
But, yeah, your heart breaks the minute you hear, you know.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so they're living with that. So then about a month later, after living what they live with every day at Quezon, they go back for what's called the payback. And they attack through the fog. The NVA don't hear them coming. And they get on them, and it's hand-to-hand flamethrowers. And it's pretty cool because the command fix bayonets comes over the radio, and everybody's like, "What?" like it's almost like it's like the 4%, you know, or Russia's Russia's economy is smaller than Canada's. What? Yeah. Fix bayonets.
Yeah.
What? Fix bayonets. And then you hear these different guys give their reactions to, and then they do that fight. And then they talk about how they felt after they gave it back, the base back after the battle. And then they talk about their life after the war, you know, self-medicating with liquor, in and out of relationships. And so it's a very stark contrast from this, what you hear. And I'll send you a link for a TED Talk that Charlie Plum gave. You know, you had John McCain run for president. You had Stockdale on the ticket for vice president. You had, I don't know how many senators come out of the Hanoi Hilton. I don't know how many congressmen came out. Governors. I mean, these guys are all, and you're like, okay, explain to me the delta. Explain to me the delta, because I don't, like, it blows my mind that that kind of intense experience. And we're talking about guys who were imprisoned, some of them 7-8 years. And that number is 4%. I don't understand it. I don't get it. So anyway,
I think part of this could also be a perception thing, because I think we have this perception of the modern veteran and who's afflicted with PTSD, and the guy who's drinking himself to death in an apartment with his, you know, failed relationships. And, you know, I did a review for a movie called Thank You for Your Service a little while back. And, you know, and I was invited to do the review by the filmmakers, which was really nice of them. But I found some of the way they depicted veterans problematic, in that it was kind of the old cliche. He comes back home and he's kind of starting to fall asleep, and he smells his dinner burning, and he has a horrible flashback. And the next thing you know, he's trying to kick in the door to his pregnant wife because he has no control over himself. That's kind of this caricature of the veteran with PTSD that we have today. But that caricature that a lot of people, even some veterans, have, it hurts us as a demographic. Because if you're a veteran who's been diagnosed with PTSD, you could very well be a high-functioning adult, you know what I mean, with a great job. You could be doing very well.
Right.
But if you identify as a veteran with PTSD, we make these assumptions about you, you know? So you can't run for president, or you can't run for Congress or governor if you say, well, yeah, I'm a combat veteran, and I was diagnosed with PTSD. Because in our minds, we see you as the same threat that the sheriff saw Rambo as in First Blood.
Right.
You know, he's a loose cannon, you know. I mean, you see that even with veterans who maybe weren't combat veterans and haven't been diagnosed with PTSD. You know, some people in our culture are like, oh, well, man, they're just one bad day away. You know, they're going to flip out. And so I can't help but wonder how much of our modern veteran generation, or how similar we really may be to these Vietnam veterans. But it's the perceptions, and it comes from a place of empathy and sympathy, you know. But I think that a lot of people who maybe were opposed to the idea of the Iraq War in the first place, things like that, they see these veterans returning home as damaged victims. You know, it's something that Mattis said a few years ago that I loved, and he was like, we need to get away from the idea of the veteran victim. You know, these are hard men, these are heroes, these are men that did what they needed to do, men and women. And they came home and they've got some problems, and they've got to work through those problems, you know, as they have in previous generations. So we need to stop writing them off because they have the problems, you know. I'm sure John McCain's got long nights, you know, or has had throughout his life, you know. I'm sure he's woken up troubled, you know. But he doesn't have the same, we don't attribute that same damaged goods perspective to a Vietnam-era veteran who saw some terrible things or experienced some terrible things that we do to an OIF or OES veteran. When we hear that he saw some bad things, we assume he's going to be screwed up, you know? Whereas lots of people in Vietnam had terrible experiences, but we expect you to either be a hippie, you know, which my dad kind of fell into that category a bit, you know, or we expect you to just be a gruff old veteran, but we don't expect you to be damaged goods. You know, and I wonder if public perception plays a role in this.
Well, I mean, your dad, public perception on him was like, hey, we don't want to deal with you, right? And they became closet veterans.
Yeah.
They didn't even tell anybody they were veterans, right?
True, it's true.
Right? They
you know,
people, Carl Marlantis, the writer, and he's a recipient of the Navy Cross in Vietnam, He talks about he coached soccer with a guy for 9 years. Both of them were in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, and neither one of them ever mentioned it.
See, that's crazy to me. You know, they found out
because their wives, one of their wives mentioned it, and the other wife says, "Oh yeah, well, my husband was in the Marine Corps in Vietnam too." Neither guy ever. Amazing.
You know, that's true to my experience. When I joined the Marines, I was working for Skip Barber Racing at the time, and I had been up for a promotion that had been kind of waiting for a little while. So when I asked my boss to come in for a meeting, he was like, I know. And I was like, no, actually, man, I signed the papers yesterday and I leave on Sunday, so I don't need a promotion anymore. But I found out that day that he had been a Marine, that had served in Vietnam. I worked for him for a year and a half, and I never knew, had no idea. Which is strange to me. I understand I work in a military-related field still. You know, I'm covering defense news every day. So my service plays a role in my day-to-day life, even now, 4 years out, you know? But I can't imagine it never playing a role in your life. It never influencing a decision or an interaction that you have with somebody. You know, when I bump into people, I ran into a guy at O'Reilly Auto Parts the other day who asked me if I was a Marine. You know, I got a big old beard, and I don't look like an active duty Marine, that's for sure. But he's like, you were a Marine, weren't you? And I said, yes, sir, I was. They said, I was a Marine, too. You know, and this guy was probably in his late 50s. We had a short conversation. It was great. It was very pleasant. You know, we went about our way. But that's not an unusual interaction for me. You know, I've been picked out as a Marine before. I can't imagine going decades without ever addressing it. That's crazy. You know, it's such a shift in our culture.
It gives you some idea of the blind side that those guys felt. Because, again, most of them, so if you were in Vietnam in 1968, let's just say you're 20, you were born in 1948. Everybody who had a role in bringing you up was a veteran or the wife of a veteran or participated in some kind of veteran cause or went to work as Rosie the Riveter, blah, blah, blah. And this was your turn. You went off to do what your uncles did, what your teachers did, what your coaches did. You know, what your mom did, what your grandma did, all were a part of something great. You went to do that. And then when you came home, you got treated with the back of everybody's hand. And what
happened? Which is
happened?
Such a polar difference than we experience today. I'll complain up and down about the VA doing a poor job, but you will be hard-pressed to find a demographic that is treated better than the veteran demographic in the United States. You know, when it comes to college benefits and things like that, serve any other country. You know, and I continue to this day, I'm living the benefits. I'm reaping the rewards of my service, you know.
I'm
fortunate for it, you know. But my father's generation, on the other hand, you know, he came home and took his uniform off, changed into civvies, and didn't tell anybody where he just came from.
And then, you know, and the other thing they did was, because there was no diagnosis, they stuffed it in the jack in the box, right, and they never went near the hand crank. Just stuff it away and don't go near them.
Do you know what my father told me about Vietnam?
What?
That he went. That's everything my father's ever told me about Vietnam. Is that, he deployed to it. He once, in a real drunken stupor, told me a real short story fast roping out of a helo. And that was it. That is everything I know about my dad's service in Vietnam. And he ran a veterans home. He ran the Vermont Veterans Home for years. So being a veteran played a very active role in his life, but it was not something that he was willing to share with his family, you know? Whereas my wife was with me, I was married before I got in. So my wife was with me through every step of the way through my service, and she knows just about everything I have to tell about what happened to me when I was in the Marine Corps. Not that I had some really, really horrible or different, I mean, I had some tough times, but you know what I mean?
No.
My wife goes
Can I tell you something? I think to a certain extent, the example that Vietnam veterans set for us, you know, they don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it's an unhealthy, that's not a healthy way to do it, okay?
Yeah, I would agree. But, you can ask my father.
Right, but nobody wanted to talk to them. And so what do you do, right? But I think a lot of guys, you know, when you like he never talks about it. Okay, that's not good. Okay, look, just so you know, I know it sounds macho. I know guys that are older than you did that. That's not good, though. Okay, So, yeah. But you see guys now, it's like, yeah, he never talks about it. Like, okay, he's going to go Roman Candle one of these days because you should talk about it. It helps. You know, whether, and if you
can. Yeah, even if we're talking about going through a rough breakup, you know what I mean? You call your buddy, you go have a beer. You might not talk about it directly, but you talk. You know, that's how you get through a rough breakup.
Right.
In terms of scope, so far, so much more minuscule than what you might experience in combat. So, I can't imagine what going through decades of your life feeling as though you can't acknowledge it. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's part of the reason why things like the VFW are starting to die out now, is because that was one of the few havens where these veterans felt that they could go and commiserate.
I agree with you. There's other ways to connect now, and there was. But let me tell you this. I think that we, as younger veterans, I'm not so young, but I think we have an obligation to go join those organizations and sustain them because they do incredible good. For instance,
I agree.
I'm in the process of joining the local Marine Corps League detachment. Why? Because I think it's good that McNamara gets involved with them, does things in the community that emphasize what Marine Corps veterans do, and that's a good thing, and I should be a part of that, and I should choose that. I think, but I think a lot of younger veterans see those guys with their red piss cutters on and go, yeah, and the red jacket, yeah, that ain't me. And they've got these organizations, they have to adapt. They have to, like, okay, maybe that was okay in World War II, you know, and Korea. But you know what? Vietnam veterans weren't so much about that, and younger veterans aren't anywhere near that. You've got to redesign your organization, or guess what? It's going to die. And
you're not wrong.
No, I know.
I think we talked about it before, but, you know, I spent 3.5 years working between 3 and 5 funerals a week, you know, and many of those funerals, you'd see the Marine Corps League attend, you know, and always really nice guys. It was always great to interact with them. But I'll be honest, because when you work a funeral, you spend, you know, 3 hours sitting in your Govy van before the funeral ever starts, just casing the cemetery and making sure that you know.
Right.
The funeral manual is pretty strict, but no cemetery actually allows for you to adhere to the funeral manual.
It's the same event as going to the range. It's 3 hours before the range, brief,
yep.
Okay? It's the same event.
Absolutely. Same, exactly. You know, but you get to spend a lot of time with these Marine Corps League guys and the Navy League guys, and they're awesome guys. You know, and I remember having this conversation with people where I was like, I would join that organization if I didn't have to wear that outfit. If I didn't have to wear that hat and get laughed at by my buddies, I'd love to be in a group like that. You know, and at the time it was just kind of a joke because we were still young, active duty guys who, as far as we knew, we were going to be like fit Marines for the rest of our lives and we'd never have to worry about it. You know, but now, you know, a little bit removed from it, it's a great way to still experience that camaraderie that you got, have somebody that you can commiserate with about your experiences, but more than that, it's a way that you can help people. You know, you can participate in the community and represent the Marine Corps in this really positive way. That's what I loved about doing funerals.
I'll give you another one. My own opinion, it's an underutilized resource by Marines as they transition. Who's already dealt with the VA in your community? The Marines in your local Marine Detachment League?
That's a great point.
Who knows?
That's a great
who knows
point.
Who all the assholes are in every veteran event going on that you'll deal with? The guys at the Marine Corps League. You know, who can help you if you meet them? Who can help you network and maybe find a job? Maybe the guys at the Marine Corps League? And so, to me, it's
that's a great, great point. Because
we do it
so
on our,
I was
our own detriment.
Retired because of my knee.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, I got a VA disability rating for it, whatnot, so on and so forth. But then one day I got a letter in the mail saying that they wanted me to come into the VA in Rhode Island, where I live in Worcester, Mass., to have them look at my knees. I got the letter the day of the appointment, and my mail comes at noon, and the appointment was at 10 a.m.
Nice.
So literally impossible for me to make it. So I called the VA up, and I said, some kind of a miscommunication here. I won't be able to make the appointment. Can we reschedule it? They said, yep, don't worry. You'll get a letter in the mail. Right? I get a letter in the mail 3 months later that said that they've reduced the rating for my knees to 0% because I didn't come to the appointment to have them evaluate them. So I called the VA again and said, there must be some kind of a mistake. What do I need to do to fix this? And they said, well, you can file an appeal. So I called an appeals attorney, and he said, I recommend just starting a whole new claim. That's much faster than an appeal. An appeal will be 3 years. A new claim might be done in 6 to 8 months. I just haven't done either. You know, but if I had called someone who had been through this experience before, you know what I mean? And they said, no, man, this is what you do. You know, this happened to me. Instead of an attorney who didn't really want to deal with me, and the VA lady who's like, you know, every light on her telephone is lit up, so she's just trying to get me off the line as fast as she can so that she can get to the next 60 guys that are going to yell at her. You know, and so what did I do? I did what lots of veterans do, which is I just accepted my fate and went about my business. Okay, so be it. But I'm in one of those situations where I'm not relying on that disability payment because I worked hard, but I have a job where I don't have to, I'm not on my feet all day. I'm not a roofer or a construction worker or a police officer, as many veterans become. And with my crap knees, if I were a roofer, I'd be in a lot of trouble right now, you know? And I'd have to wait 3 years for that appeal or file a new claim and out lost in the woods. And, you know, and you're right. Those organizations like the Marine Corps League or the VFW, the American Legion might even be able to help. You know, those organizations have got to be a great resource. I wish I had thought of that at the time, you know?
Yeah, no, it's how we screwed up when we transition. Because, again, we're put off by the red blazers and like, but if you gave it some thought, who can help you network? Who can just sit down and be your friend and say, hey, look, man, here's what you're going to go through. And if you need anybody else, Harry's a real estate agent, right? Larry, he works for Budweiser. He works for the state. He can help you with this. And you're just like, dude.
You know, because what's the biggest fear every Marine's got if he's looking to separate? You know, it's, am I going to be able to find work? Can I support my family?
Yeah.
You know, and it's a strong retention tool for the Marine Corps because your first sergeant will tell you there's no jobs. You know, when you go in to talk to your first sergeant and you say, you know, first sergeant, I'm thinking about getting out. He'll be like, oh, you're not going to find work. You're going to be homeless. If that's what you want, you know, I mean, I'll sign the paper. Here's your checkout list. You know, and I was terrified of it. I joined the Marines at 21. I had an associate's degree I earned while I was on active duty. You know, over 6 years it took me to get that damn thing. But I had no idea that I'd be able to find work on the other side. That was my biggest trepidation. And again, you're right, networking. I've learned since, networking is how you get a job. It's not making sure that you've got the right watermark on your resume, because no one gives a shit about watermark. But that's what they teach you at Steps and Taps, is to make sure the watermark's facing the right way in your resume, make sure it's the properly weighted paper. They actually taught me not to salt my food if it's a lunch interview, because it would show that I'm too set in my ways, and hiring managers would be reluctant to hire me. It's all bullshit.
What?
None of the stuff they taught me at Steps and Taps helped me get a job.
You know what? And let me just tell you, here's McNamara. You know, what I've learned and the wisdom that All Marine Radio spreads, don't write your own resume. Hire a professional resume writer because they understand keywords. They understand, you know.
That's the secret.
Cover letters. Right? And so all of a sudden I bring she's a retired Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant. Her name's Linda Field. And so somebody says, hey, you should interview her. I said, okay. So I bring her on and she says, yeah, let me just tell you how this works. Most Marines don't even get in a pile to be interviewed because their resumes are all jacked up. They don't take keywords out of the job description, put them in their cover letter and in their resume, and so they screw it up. I'll do all that for you. You got to tell me what you want, and then we can tweak it as necessary. And I'm listening going, why didn't somebody tell me this? Why didn't somebody tell me?
I can support that as when I graduated with my bachelor's degree, I got a job as a regional HR manager in charge of 5 facilities in New England for a defense contractor. We did components on some legacy aircraft like the F-16 and stuff like that. Mostly we just soldered microchips, you know, and my job was to hire people to solder these microchips.
Right.
When we were sifting through resumes, during that same period of time, my wife was a corporate recruiter. She was doing the same work. When we're sifting through resumes, we're not even looking at them. We're searching for the keywords that we included in the job posting that we put up. Because that's what we want. That's what we're looking for. So people, first and foremost, start out in your freaking picture and your resume and all that other bullshit. Make sure you spell all the words properly. but it's a reading comprehension test. When you see that job listing, we're giving you the answers to our questions. We're saying we look for someone with expertise or experience in this, this, and this. We're looking for someone who has done this, this, and this. In your resume, make sure you use those words, because I'm just going to control F it, and if I don't get any results, I'm not going to read the resume. It's not anything personal. It's just that I've got 1,000 of them.
Right.
You know? And people lose sight of it. We get so hung up on this 1980s idea of hiring, right, where you got to make sure you print it out in the properly weighted paper, and you put on your Sunday best, and you go and you present that resume by hand so that you can get face time with the hiring manager. Hiring managers are so far removed from the receptionist that you'll never meet them, first and foremost. Second of all, if you give them a paper resume, they're going to throw it away because they have to put everything into a database to justify every hiring decision they make. So you just gave them homework, you know? But that's what we're training Marines to do. We're training them to get a job in 1988, you know? And that's not the job market today.
No.
I love that there's somebody out there who's like, no, I will untrust your resume for you. You tell me what it is that you're looking to do. This is what I'm good at. You go be good at what you're good at. You know, that's awesome. You know, is she running a business doing this?
Yeah. Yeah. She has her own resume writing business. And, Linda.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And so you're going to talk to a Marine and they're going to and again, it's like we did a little bit ago. Don't write your resume. You're too stupid. I'll do it and I'll get you the interviews. You work on your interview skills. Huh? Okay. Got it. Yeah. I got it. What do you need? And all of a sudden you work. But how much time in those TAP classes do you spend on resume writing? Here's the model. Here's this. You're like, come on. $250 and Linda Fields gives you 10% off if you say you heard about it on All Marine Radio. You know, it's like.
And how much money do we devote to this stuff in TAP training? That, I mean, I'll tell you, when I went through it, it was a retired gunny that had switched over basically. You know, she retired after 20 years, took off, put on some civvies, and came back to work at the GS. And she was teaching this class on how to get a job when she had never gotten one. You know, she was working in the same, she's been in the system for, 30 years now. But she's never been on the job market, especially the modern job market that's search-based instead of interaction-based. You know, and so what she was telling us was she was teaching us the things that she was taught to teach us, not the things that she had experienced as effective. You know, and that's a big problem. There's a gap between what we're teaching and what you can use practically, but it's because the people that are teaching it or the people who are producing these classes haven't been in the job market.
Well,
you know?
They're
pulling it out of manuals instead of experience.
And
that's the wrong way to do it.
And so when you talk to people like Linda, you're like, wow. Wow. Now this kind of makes more sense to me. And then, like I said, why we don't all use, the Marine Corps, and that's why we should join those organizations. Why? Because it's in our benefit. Why do you keep your honor clean in combat? Because you got to live with it. It's in your benefit, you don't do it for the institution. You do it because it's in your best interest. And so I would make the same case. But, you know, we're socially averse to it. Like,
you get out, you're 22, you know, you think you're a badass, you're walking around in your tap-out t-shirt, and you don't want to go hang out with that old-timer.
Right.
You know, and that's what you think you're going to go do when you go to the VFW is it's going to be a dark room with three guys in the back smoking cigarettes just yelling at each other about Vietnam. a good friend of mine, Luke Ryan, he's a writer for Stop Rep. He's a Ranger. You know, this guy's got like 3 Purple Hearts. He's every bit the hero that you would think you read about or you'd see in a movie. Very unassuming guy, though. You'd probably never know unless he told you. And he just went to a VFW recently for the first time and had an incredible experience. And I had a bad experience my one and only time going to a VFW in Massachusetts, and it kind of soured me. And Luke convinced me maybe I should reassess, and now you're convincing me even more. But he went to a VFW in Tampa, I believe, and he said that the inside was beautiful. You know, it was welcoming. The people were very friendly and welcoming. He said that it felt like he was coming home. as opposed to walking into a room full of strangers.
Well, I would say this.
I haven't had that experience, but that's a good one.
I would say this. I mean, to me, start at the Marine Corps League because that's home, right? That they speak our language, they habla, and so to me, and then build it out from there. That's where you get advice that you would pay for in a lot of different places, and so. Interesting. All right, you got a couple. I've given you like three assignments, right? So number one, you got to watch Bravo, and then give some thought to footnoting the Hanoi Hilton thing. How is that? You know, and I agree with you. I'm curious now to read more. So 4%. What does that mean? What does that mean? There's no way that those guys can't be impacted by that experience the rest of their lives. So how do we diagnose it, and how do they escape the diagnosis, right? So 4% of what number? Did some of them simply not be screened for it? Because I don't. So I'm kind of curious about that. What's the deal on that? And
especially because when it comes to things like this, it's difficult to be quantitative
right. When
it comes to feelings, right? And I mean, I'll say myself. I've wondered at times, you know, because as we've talked about, you know, I've had guys kill themselves that were under my command, and I've had some rough times. And now, I could not tell you when I'm having my darker days whether or not it's tied to that or if it's just how I'm hardwired. You know, my mom always said I skew dark anyway, right? So
your mom says that?
My mom has said that, yeah. My mom has said, well, you know, you skew dark, you know. I guess thanks, Mom. I appreciate it. You know, but I think that I'm probably a depression-prone person, but not a depressed person, maybe. But I don't know that I would cite the Marine Corps for it if it's just the way I came from the factory. You know,
right.
And I think that it's got to be tough for a lot of guys to make that distinction. You know, the Marine Corps for a lot of us was our formative years. So when you come out the other side of your formative years and you're this person now, it's hard to know which elements were strictly the Marine Corps and which elements of that are just who I am as I grew, you know? And I wonder if percentages look lower because in previous generations, people would just say, well, that guy's just a dark guy, you know? And where in some cases that might be the case, and in others it couldn't, but because we weren't looking for it, we weren't actively looking for PTSD diagnoses in that generation of veteran. I wonder if that generation of veteran wasn't looking for it in themselves. So when you ask them, they go, hell no. You know, I drink every night. Like, yeah, I'm divorced 6 times and my credit score is 11. You know, but that's all just me. You know, like, sure, I wake up in cold sweats and I cry a lot, but that's just me.
That's just me.
You know, whereas now, if you were to meet a 30-year-old veteran, you know, who did 3 humps in Afghanistan, and, you know, and he came back home and his marriage fell apart, and he can't hold down a steady job, and he's struggling, he'll tell you that it's a result of his experiences in Afghanistan. But if you see that same Vietnam veteran 40 years ago, and you ask him those questions, he would tell you, my life's just fucked up. I'm fucked up. You know, and so I wonder if, I have to assume that the percentage of people affected by these things, because we all deal with stress differently. You know, it's not a better or worse than others. It's just that some people are affected more dramatically than others. I have to feel like the percentages have to be pretty similar, but we just aren't looking at it the same way. I don't know. It's crazy to me.
Yeah. Email's asking me a question, and I'll ask you to comment. Did you get around to reading the Garwood VC story on Sofra? Chilling. Are you familiar with the story about this Garwood?
I believe it's the story that we were referring to as White Kong around the office. I only got to skim the early drafts of it because I've been on the road for my whole life now. But it was effectively, from my understanding, from talking to Jack Murphy, who wrote the story. He's our editor in chief. Former Army Ranger and Green Beret. The story was about a patrol in Vietnam that came across a unit of Viet Cong that was led by a white guy, by an American. I don't know the rest of the details of the story. I just kind of got the cliff notes of it. But that's a crazy, crazy thing to think about. I know that he got a lot of pushback from veterans that were in the unit that came across him. One guy, who obviously I won't tell you who he was, but Jack got a hold of the guy, and he was like, yep, everything that you heard about that is true. Lose my phone number, fuck yourself. He did not want to talk about it, you know, but really, really interesting story, if that's the one he's referring to.
Yeah,
I've been on the road for a week, so I haven't been keeping up with what's on the website. In case you're wondering where my stories look a little dated lately, everybody.
Yeah, no, you're going through some family stuff. Talk to me about, all right, so what are you writing about next?
Well, I've got a story that should be coming out here pretty soon, either today or tomorrow, about how the Navy just stood up the Second Fleet again.
Right.
They stood down the Second Fleet in 2011 as a cost-saving measure. You know, the Second Fleet for 65 years was responsible for Eastern Seaboard defense, Northern Atlantic presence, you know, particularly to counter Russia during the Cold War. You know, but in 2011, we were like, we don't do peer or near-peer warfare anymore. At the same time, we were canceling the F-22 programs, and we were doing a lot of nearsighted things in that era, you know, during the Obama administration. In the interest of saving money to put towards OIF, I'd have to assume. So we stood down Second Fleet and built, you know, our Fleet Force Command or something along that nature in that region. Now, as of this past week, we have officially, on paper, stood the Second Fleet up again. And NATO wants to stand a similar command up that we volunteered to let be based out of Norfolk, Virginia. And we aren't being shy about it. We said right in the official statement that we're standing Second Fleet up to counter Russian aggression in the Northern Atlantic. What's really interesting to me about this is that in March, Russia released a whole bunch of propaganda, is what I called it at the time. I still tend to call it propaganda, claiming that they sent a whole bunch of their nuclear attack submarines to the Eastern Seaboard earlier this year in a training operation literally just to see if they could park their subs right outside of important naval installations along America's East Coast. According to them, they successfully did it. Then they left without being detected, and now they're creating a new docuseries that'll be on Russian television talking about what went on. At the time, the Navy didn't acknowledge it or address it at all. And I think that was the right move. Because if you say, no, it didn't happen, it sounds like Russia's right and we didn't know. If you say, yeah, it did happen, then you may be betraying some information that we have, like the way that we're tracking our stealthier nuclear subs, which are tough. You know, they're electric powered. There's not a lot of moving parts. They're quiet.
Right.
So the fact that we all of a sudden, a month and a half later, announced that we're standing up the Second Fleet again, but we don't logistically know how. They stood the fleet up, and they said, we'll come up with a commander, and we'll come up with how the logistics of getting ships up there in the coming months. That leads me to believe that it's a response to something.
Well, it was a response. It was out of the, was it the Quadrennial Review? Or based on the reading I did, it was based on... Oh, the command was merged into Fleet Forces Command in 2011, but the Navy has been talking about bringing it back since it appeared as a recommendation in the Strategic Readiness Review after last year's Seventh Fleet collision. So there was a series of recommendations done by the Navy in their readiness review, and this is one of them. So. Interesting.
You know, I have to assume the nuclear posture review that came out earlier this year must have played a role as well, because the Status 6, we call it the Canyon with a K, it's a doomsday weapon, man. It's a submersible drone. It's about 80 feet long. My wife was knocking on the window there. It's about 80 feet long, about 5 feet wide. It's a 100 megaton nuclear weapon with a 6,200 mile range that can be deployed by their submarine. Now, there were murmurs of this Status 6, this Canyon weapons platform, for months, for years now, and we all just kind of burst it off as, you know, Russian propaganda. They make a lot of claims. You know, they announced that they have an atomic-powered missile that makes zero sense, but people wanted to be scared of it, so we just brushed it off. But in this most recent nuclear posture review, we included the Status 6 Canyon weapons platform on our assessment of Russia's nuclear capabilities, which means we must have some actionable intelligence to support the idea that this weapons platform really exists. We're talking 100 megatons, you know? That's, to give you a frame of reference, Hiroshima was a 16 kiloton bomb. You know, it killed between 90 and 140,000 people. There's, it's like 100 or 1,000 kilotons in one megaton. We're talking about something that's twice the size of the largest nuclear test ever detonated. The Tsar Bomba was 50 megatons. Russia blew that up, and that was the biggest nuke anyone's ever detonated anywhere on the planet. We did it once. This Status 6 weapon is twice as powerful as that. It could wipe out a city and produce a radioactive tidal wave that would go hundreds of miles inland. We don't know how many they have. Apparently, the DOD at least believes that they do have them. And because of things like this and their claims of sending attack subs to our eastern seaboard, we are really ramping up a lot of initiatives to detect submarines. One of them is, I call it the Aquaman program. DARPA's working on it. They call it PALS. They're using sensors to track marine life because submarines and these Status 6 drones have an electromagnetic field that wildlife will react to as it travels through the water. So if we can keep track of how marine wildlife behaves and we see them scattering out of a linear trajectory, we can assume there's something in there moving that's scattering this wildlife. And we just accepted delivery of our first drone warship. It's a sub-hunting warship. Now, no offensive armaments thus far, but they literally just crisscross permanently in an area looking for submarines. We're really moving quickly to try to find ways to detect and counter Russian submarines. It leads me to believe that the threat posed by them is probably bigger than we're acknowledging publicly. We wouldn't be throwing this much money at it if it wasn't an actual concern. You know, and if you ask me, standing up the second fleet is a continuation of that. You know, there's a legitimate concern, there's a legitimate threat posed by Russia. I mean, in the Baltics, obviously.
Right.
And then obviously out into the North Atlantic. And then further, when we talk about, as ice caps melt, Russia is really, really militarizing the Arctic. And, right now the Coast Guard primarily is responsible for that. And now with the second fleet, we're going to have a naval presence in that region. And I really think that the Arctic waterways that are opening up are going to become kind of the next South China Sea. It's going to be a really heavily trafficked, for commercial purposes, area of the globe. And you're going to get a lot of diplomatic leverage if you can control that militarily. And Russia's moving to do that. So the Second Fleet, I think, is a great idea. But I wonder what it is that they know that isn't publicly information that makes us push for these things so quickly, you know?
All right. Alex Holling, got to get back on the road if his wife's knocking on the window. First of all, Alex, we appreciate you coming on today. And drive safe and tell everybody where they find your work at SOFREP.
Well, definitely go to SOFREP.com. You know, I write for SOFREP, but there are a ton of great writers. You know, for instance, that Vietnam story we were just talking about that I need to catch up on. There is some awesome content on there. But if you're looking for just me, you can find me on Facebook at Facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter, or you can find me on Twitter at AlexHollings52.
There you have it, the one and only Alex Hollings. Alex, thanks for the visit. Good luck with the drive. Stay safe.
Thanks, brother.
There you have
it. All right, catch you soon.
All right, there you have it. Alex Hollings here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Don't touch that dial. The gunner is going to join us. That's right. The one and only, Michael Musselman, coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt. Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.